You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
2018, and we are well on our way to world domination. Woohoo! Tamara here, your host. Hello to you and to the second week of 2018, where we kick off our amazing innovator interviews. So, question for you. Do you ever wish you were more tuned into the macro trends happening around you? I don't know. Sometimes it feels like I recognize the big trends that affect our businesses when it's almost too late, when I'm looking in the rearview mirror, not when I'm looking forward, when I can actually do something about it, when I can actually leverage it for bigger impact. That is why I wanted to kick off the year with Rohit Bhargava. He's an innovation and trend thought leader. In fact, he just published the 2018 trends report called The Non-Obvious, How to Predict Trends and Win the Future. By the way, this is not his first year doing this. He is well into this, so he knows his stuff. We dig into some of the big trends and how you can actually curate the trends around you too. So I found our conversation around enlightened consumption and something called manipulated outrage particularly of interest to all of us. And oh yeah, and we need to be observant and fickle about our experiences and our insights. That's another thing that we talked about. Now, I think Rohit's innovator archetype is a futuristic inquisitive, which means for him, innovation is in the questions, not the answers, challenging assumptions. That's the inquisitive side. And in looking into tomorrow for solutions, not to today or even the past. That's the futuristic side. He definitely leverages these natural strengths in his work. I think it's what makes him actually so good at it. And you'll hear it in particular when he talks about the impact of the trends and how he actually curates them and finds them to begin with. It's totally fascinating. So get ready to rock your 2018 world. Here we go. I am so excited for this interview. This is going to be a great way to kick off the year. Rohit, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. So before we, look into the future of 2018, let's start with you. What's one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
I think that I am a drummer and a percussionist, which actually serves me well for the business world, too, because when you're a drummer, you got to get all four limbs doing something different, which I think is a good example of multitasking.
So I have to ask, have you always drummed? Have you done it since a kid? Did you pick it up as an adult?
I sort of taught myself in middle school because I was frustrated with being in the band, because if you're a percussionist in a band, you basically sit there and count for 10 minutes and then you hit the cymbal once. And I hate that. So I taught myself how to play the drum set in response.
It's funny. I think you're right, though. The idea of – I've only tried drumming at, 1 in the morning after being in a bar. So – and I was amazing. I'm pretty sure of it. But the idea of having to get everything working together was probably the hardest part.
Yeah, it is. And it really does kind of teach you a little bit about that independence kind of thing. So I can do that whole rub my tummy and pat my head thing. I can do that.
You're like, I got this. No sweat. Totally on it. Well, let's dig in. So the reason we wanted to have you on, particularly this time of year, is because you do a lot of trend predictions. And as you call it, in really the non-obvious, not only way, but you look for the non-obvious too. So let's start with a little bit about it. Tell me a little bit about your view about how the secret to predicting the future is a matter of understanding the present.
Yeah, I think we put a lot of pressure on ourselves, and maybe it's founded by people who call themselves futurists, which I don't usually use as a term for myself, because we tend to think, you have to look so far into the future about things that may or may not happen. And instead, I predict trends every year. And in every December, I come out with a new book. And the methodology behind it is really paying attention to what's happening right now. And the prediction is that this idea or this thing is going to accelerate. And so that's what we're predicting. But the signs of that future are already here in the present, which is why I use that term accelerating present.
Do you find that the trends that you see are ones that have hit a tipping point, they've been around, and then over time they hit that tipping point and they exploded? Or do some of them come out of nowhere? Does that question even make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, they do come out of nowhere in some cases, because really what the process for us does, myself and my team, is it puts different things that people are looking at together into one thing. And so this idea of intersection is really important for us when it comes to trends. Like, I don't focus on financial services trends or retail trends or healthcare trends. Our trends are not described in that way. In fact, most of them have multiple industry examples. And that's what makes it really interesting, because now what you're looking for is connections. Instead of saying, okay, I'm over here and you're over there, we're trying to put the pieces together.
Why do you think most trend predictions are useless?
Most trend predictions are useless because they're lazy. I think that someone will see something and, you know, I guarantee you, we're, you know, at the beginning of the year, and I guarantee you that someone will say a trend is Bitcoin.
Right. Which is I've already heard that. Yeah.
You know, yeah. Because like Bitcoin is something that exists, right? The idea of decentralized currency, that could be a trend. But Bitcoin is just something that exists. And so a lot of times what you'll see as a quote unquote trend prediction is actually just someone saying that something exists that they heard about.
You know, it's so funny. When I was back in the day, I worked on Madison Avenue when it mattered. And, you know, you had your big global ad agencies. And one of our jobs as junior account people was to go out and quote unquote spot trends. And what that really meant was find cool and interesting things in the stores or on the streets or that people were wearing. And looking back, after reading your book, it made me realize how kind of flawed that was and how behind we really were. And not understanding, I guess, the why behind it, which is what I hear you saying with the Bitcoin example.
Yeah, I think that really what it comes down to is we as people, if you can train yourself to be more observant, you can spot ideas. And idea spotting is a beautiful thing. We should all be idea spotters. That doesn't make it a trend, though. Like, what makes it a trend is the same thing that makes flour, eggs, and sugar on a shelf into a cake. Like, you have to turn it into something, right? You can't just look on the shelf and be like, there's a cake. Can you imagine it? I'm like, maybe, but that doesn't make it.
I'd like to have you bake it first. How's that sound?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, so idea spotting, great. Trend spotting, I don't think that exists. I mean, the terminology I use is trend curation instead, because I think you're curating things, you're putting things together.
Before we dig into the trends, which I really want to get into, tell me your definition of trend. I want for the launch readers out there to have a stake in the ground of what we're really talking about.
Yeah, my definition of a trend is that it's a curated observation of the accelerating present.
So I'm trying to write that as you talk. So a little slight pause there.
Yes.
I was like, wait, I got to remember that.
No,
I got to remember that.
I should. So a curated observation, which means you're observing multiple things and then you're putting it together. And I use this word curation very intentionally, right? Because if you think about it, most of us have heard the word from museums. And a museum will curate, and what that means is if they have 1,000 paintings or 100 paintings, they'll show you the best 20. They won't show you all 100 or all 1,000 because they're trying to tell a story. And we have to do the same thing with ideas. We have to figure out what's meaningful, what isn't. We have to be strategic about choosing them, and that's where the idea of curation comes in.
And when did you anchor on accelerated? I think that's a really fascinating way to think about it.
That, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, some things, I mean, you'll appreciate this from your Madison Avenue time. Some things you deliberate on for a long time, and some things you just kind of say, this is what it is, and it just feels right.
It just feels right.
With that word, I mean, it just felt right because these are accelerating, right? I mean, if it is a trend, it should be accelerating. Otherwise, why would you call it a trend?
Well, good point. Otherwise, it's just a fad, right? Or an idea, I suppose.
Right.
So it's January when we're releasing this podcast, the very beginning. I know we're all looking into, you know, 2018 and beyond and what our work is going to include, what our life is going to include and all that good stuff. I'd love to dig into some of those trends as you've curated them and as you see them. So you wrote The Non-Obvious, How to Predict Trends and Win the Future, and I read it. And I was totally blown away for a lot of reasons. I'd say one is I felt like your whole concept around curated, number one, and accelerated, which we've already talked about. But two, the whole idea that a lot of these were the underlying factors as to why we're seeing the things we're seeing versus the kind of superficial level of it, just to go back to your Bitcoin example. I wish we had time to go into all of them, but I also want people to have a reason to go buy your book because it's so good. So let's focus on the top three, and if we have time, we'll add in a fourth. Will you go through with me? Let's talk about the ones that you think are the big ones that we should be paying attention to.
Sure. Yeah. And I, you know, and I'm happy to, if there's any one that stood out for you, we can definitely go there as well. One that I think was really interesting was something that I called enlightened consumption. And enlightened consumption really speaks to this idea that consumers, both retail consumers, but also business consumers, like B2B consumers, are caring and paying more attention to how a business operates and what is doing to the world or for the world. And what that means is that we are becoming more conscious about the choices that we make. And so technology is enabling that in some ways. So you have apps where you can scan a barcode and you can see whether the coffee that you're buying was sourced from a particular place or not. You have diamonds and eco diamonds and the whole kind of flux between those two, and people kind of feeling like they want to make ethical choices for how both are sourced. And this is a fundamental shift now, because these things that used to be part of a crusty old sustainability report somewhere that only investors cared about are now going front and center.
So talk to me a little bit about, like, as someone looking outward in, how that trend shows up. How am I seeing it? Like, I get what you're saying, that it's no longer the, you know, the VP of sustainability is the only one who cares about it. It's becoming bigger. But will you take it to that next level?
Yeah, the next level becomes that all of a sudden you get ruled out before you even get considered for something that has nothing to do with your product or your product attributes, really. You're being measured on this other dimension. If you imagine, like, the criteria for a purchaser, you know, this was never really a major one in the past. And so no company would have imagined, oh, we're getting ruled out because of how we're doing business or not doing business in this particular way with a larger number of consumers. Of course, there's always going to be some people that cared about that, but it never felt big. And now it has become big.
So how do we gauge that? Is this like the one for like Tom's shoes, just to use an obvious example? Is it much deeper than that? How are we now going about making those decisions?
So we, I think, as consumers, I mean, one way is that these decisions are being used front and center for us. And so the brands that aren't living it and that aren't transparent on it, all of a sudden, like, we don't have a reason to stick with them anymore, because we don't have that sense of pride. And it doesn't say what we want it to say about us as consumers, because a big part of this is also identity, right? If I go to Patagonia and I buy from Patagonia, that says something about my identity, versus if I go somewhere else where a brand's not doing any of those things, even though they could be, you know, I don't feel the same about it.
Wow. It's so interesting to me to think that so I'm a Gen Xer, for whatever that's worth. I'm squeezed in the middle between the two big generations. But it seems like, to your point about acceleration, that we've had this huge swing where it used to be all about the product and the service and, like, having the best product out there. And now we've really swung to, not that the product doesn't matter, let's assume it has to be good, but it's the company and how it does business that matters. And that's what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can be ruled out because of it. I think the other layer in there of what you said that's so interesting to me is the transparency part, which is, you may be doing all the good in the world, but if I don't know about it, I'm not going to care about you either. There's a transparency that's, I think, happening in business that hasn't happened in the past.
Yeah, and it's kind of become urgent to tell that story too. I mean, you can't just hide it on the second layer of your About Us page anymore.
Right.
It has to come out, like, you know, front and center in many ways, because not only does it have an impact in consumption, as in who buys your stuff, but also consumption in terms of, like, who chooses to work for you or who doesn't.
Right. Right. Exactly. And I think I just looked at the report of Glassdoor, and I went and I was digging in Glassdoor, and it was interesting to see how many people made comments about what the company does for sustainability, human rights, you know, fill in the blank, not just about what it was like to work for them directly in their day jobs.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
All right, so give me a second one. I've got a third I want to throw in, but I'll let you guide first. So what's the second one we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, the second one I think that's interesting is Lightspeed Learning. And Lightspeed Learning describes this expectation that we're increasingly having, where we can learn how to do anything almost instantly. And there was this really interesting story that I wrote about in the book of this 8-year-old kid who decided later in the evening that he was hungry for a burger from McDonald's. And he went on YouTube and he taught himself how to drive, and he took his parents' car, with his younger sister in the front seat, and he drove to McDonald's.
I loved that story.
And you know, and he got there, and the people working there thought they were being pranked, and when they realized they weren't, they called the police, and the police came, and the boy was crying because he realized he did something wrong, and the parents came, and when they eventually figured it out. And by the way, he drove there perfectly, like obeyed all the traffic signs according to witnesses. And it was like, you know, perfect. And, you know, when they asked him, he said, yeah, I went on YouTube and I figured out how to do this. And like, that is the perfect example of like how we're learning to do anything. I mean, if you've watched any of those Tasty videos, right, where it's like this 30-second video and it turns like a bunch of ingredients into a meal and it's like a recipe video, and you watch that and you're like, okay, now I know how to cook like, you know, chicken parmesan.
I'm now a gourmet chef. Look at that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's the, you know, that coupled with this whole kind of crisis that's happening in higher education, like you put those pieces together and you're like, wow, my expectation is like, why do I have to spend 4 years in college anymore? And you've got like universities like Purdue saying, okay, we have a 3-year degree now, because your expectation is like, this has got to get faster and faster.
Do you think in some ways that that actually helps us be more creative and innovative? And the place I'm coming from in asking that question is, sometimes I think that we get too myopic in our thinking, right? We get too expert and we don't go wide. But this ability to touch and learn so many different things gives us such a broader perspective too.
It does. I mean, the on-demand element of this is a really interesting thing. I mean, you've got Fender, the maker of guitars, who decided that they were going to create an entire online learning system that allows you to learn with beautiful 4K HD videos, and it's got like split screen between the guitarist, and you can see like their hands moving along the frets. And their whole reason for that is because a lot of people buy the guitar, they pick up the instrument, and then they give up because they don't get good fast enough. And so their whole idea behind the Fender Play platform was, let's help people get good fast enough by helping them play the songs that they love so that they stick with the guitar, and then they buy the amps and the new guitar and all the other stuff from Fender, and they make money.
This trend has so many different layers to me. I think on the – and I'd love to hear your perspective on this. I think on the internal level, it's how do I communicate with my leadership, my employees, my team in a way that matches this lightning speed learning, since that's what we're doing in our everyday lives. How do I communicate that, my brand, my business in lightning speed to my customers? And then how do I give them the opportunity to learn in that way too?
Yeah, I think the positive side of that is, yeah, let's let people learn all these skills and let's help them do it faster, and let's use digital learning and online learning platforms. And, you know, I've got a whole kind of thing that I'm planning around building online learning, because that's how people want to learn. The flip side of this, how to make sure that we're not diluting, you know, what we learn down to just like hacking the thing instead of actually generating real knowledge.
That's a real concern too.
You know, I don't know. I don't think there's a magic formula. I mean, I think there are some things where you will always want people to go deep. I mean, I'm not sure I want my, oral surgeon watching a YouTube video and then operating. Like, that's probably not a good idea, you know. But at the end of the day, like, there's a balance here with these things, and the availability of that sort of content and that sort of learning. I mean, it is ultimately has the potential to be helpful, because what it does is it helps us to better understand things from people who have expertise.
So the one I wanted to bring in, actually there's two, if that's okay, if we have the time, I'd love to do both of them. One is manipulated outrage.
Sure.
I thought that was fascinating. So will you talk about what that trend is?
Yes. Manipulated outrage was me kind of going in and saying, okay, there's all this news, and all this news is making us angry, whether it's fake or real. And the question I started wondering is, well, who's profiting from this? Like, what's the business model of outrage?
Right. Why is this so big?
And that's
big
really
today?
What this chapter talks about. Yeah. Like, who's making money on all this outrage? Like, obviously, it's generating clicks to stories, and clicks generate advertising online. So that's kind of the obvious business model for outrage. But there's also this whole business model of belief, where the more angry we are, the more we care. And the challenge of getting people to care is a big one for anybody in marketing, communications, and, you know, any business really. And we care about stuff that we hate, and that's a sad truth. And I think that in politics, people are benefiting from that. I think in business, sometimes people are benefiting from that. And so really where this chapter kind of nets out is, well, what does it take to A, be a responsible business who isn't just leveraging outrage to try and do shady business, but also as a consumer of the outrage, right? How are we letting ourselves get manipulated and how can we get smarter?
So this is so interesting to me. This is what I like to do when I travel. This probably makes me a little weird, but whatever. I don't have cable at home for a lot of reasons. And when I travel, and I spend a lot of time in hotel rooms, I will flip between CNN and Fox News, just to use politics and kind of entertainment media as our example. And I'm always fascinated by how they're both touting outrage just on very different sides. And their language is, you know, very bombastic and hurtful and angry, just with a different perspective on the same thing. And sometimes I'll go online and look too to see who's covering what, because I just find it interesting. But it is. But after I have it on for a while, I start to feel really mad and really aggressive. And yeah. I mean, is it a matter of like there's a big business behind outrage and we need to be paying attention to it and tapping into it? It's like, what do we do about it? Because it is so pervasive in our culture. I think it's such a spot on trend. One of the ones that really resonated with me because you see it in everything now.
Yeah, and I think, there's a couple ways that I would suggest to respond to it. One is that there's certain types of media that generate more outrage than others. So watching someone who is basically someone you consider to be a humongous blowhard on TV talking about stuff that makes you like physically angry is a more deeper emotion than if you were to read something like that. And so, you know, one thing is like,
so the medium
stop
matters.
Watching cable news. Yeah, the medium matters. And so, you know, stop watching cable news would be one, you know, possible response to that, right? The opinion news, of which I would say like 90% of it is. The second thing would be, you know, find news from unlikely suspects or from curators that you actually trust. So, for example, The Skim is a great email newsletter, which I'm not really the target audience for because it's targeted at women. But it takes the news of the day and it shares it with you in sort of a tone that kind of indicates that this is your well-informed big sister, kind of just, you know, filling you in on all the stuff you need to know. And that's another way of kind of taking the news and instead of going like super one-sided, you find a source that you feel is somewhat more trustworthy.
It's, you know, The Skim. So I get The Skim and every morning I skim it. I look at it. Here's what I find kind of intriguing about The Skim and what's happened. So now once they got wildly successful, I mean, they got a million, you know, subscribers overnight. It was just one of these great success stories. And you're right. There were these two women who said, wait a minute, we read the wires and turn it into news every day. Why can't we just give people the facts in their inbox, right, every day? And it's super cool because you're right. It is like big sister, like, hey, yo, you might want to know this. It's not a blah, blah in your face. What's interesting to me, though, is then CNN, Huffington Post, you fill in the blank. They all tried to do the same thing and copy Skim. I think what's interesting is they didn't tap into why people liked Skim or why they were going there versus other places. They just said, oh, we want to give people news in their inbox without thinking about, I think, to a lot of what you talk about, which is the non-obvious trends behind it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, to a large degree, those attempts failed because
they
didn't have that trustworthiness that people responded to. And if you think about, like, you know, why that is the way it is or why Next Draft is so popular or why, like, Brain Pickings from Maria Popova is, like, you know, such an awesome newsletter. All of these are, like, those were the email newsletters that I sought to copy when I created my own weekly newsletter. And the whole idea behind it was what were the most non-obvious, interesting stories of the week? And could I share those with people in a way that wasn't biased but just said, look, this is why it's important. And that's it. And so that was what I tried to do. And so for the last year, like, that's been my newsletter. Like, that's it. That's what I try and deliver.
Yeah, it's a good newsletter. I would encourage all of our listeners out there to go sign up for it because it's fantastic. And we'll put a link in the show notes. So I have a third, but you might have one too. So I'll go with what you want, and then we'll throw mine in as a bonus.
No, let's go with –
Are you
let's
sure?
go with you.
Okay.
Yeah, I
wanted to go with the human mode. And the reason why is when I got to that one – it made me think about all the conversations I've had recently and, you know, the various keynotes and clients that we work with in innovation, this tension that everybody feels between technology and human experience. And there's a lot of, I think, confusion around what to do about that. You know, on one hand, technology can do all these amazing things and it makes us efficient and better and smarter and, you know, access to things faster. On one hand, it takes out the human touch. Yet on the other hand, do we want the human touch? These are the conversations I'm hearing. And then you kind of nailed it, I think, in that trend. So human mode.
Yeah, thank you. Well, thank you. I think that this one is definitely one of them already, I can tell, one of the more popular ones from the trend report. And I think what's interesting about this one is, yes, you know, people in many cases prefer human interaction as opposed to the technology, and they trust it more. What was interesting about this trend, though, was, and it was very intentionally named, was that there is increasingly going to be a human mode, which means there's a non-human mode also. Mm. And so the human mode will be an option for people. And in some cases, that option will be a premium option, so you'll have to pay more to access it. In other cases, it'll be an option where you can switch off one thing and switch on the other thing. But that's what's really interesting about it, that now we're living in a technology and automation-based world where having people, real people, is actually a alternative and an option, but not necessarily the default. Mm. And that was what was really interesting about the research that we started doing around this.
So are you saying that it's not so much a matter of either or, it's a matter of options?
Sometimes it is either or. I mean, it's not that, you know, I mean, there are online only banks where there are no people, right?
Yeah.
So sometimes there is either or, but increasingly, like, we are going to be looking at the human mode as an option that we can sometimes choose to engage and sometimes we can choose not to. And you see this, you know, particularly when you think about like chatbots and, you know, online service and customer service. I mean, this is big in that world.
I think for launch readers out there listening, what is so important and what Rohit is saying in this one in particular is the fact that it is a mode, just like technology or other aspects are a mode, that it's not this spectrum necessarily or even mutually exclusive of each other. Did I get that right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that, you know, really it does sort of indicate that, you know, there was a fascinating story that was part of this around the human library. And the human library is essentially a library of people where you can check out a person for a half hour conversation. And it's just a concept that cool. is basically a bunch of events. And you can kind of go there and run your own human library. But it got so popular that they actually have a permanent human library now, a couple of them, but a permanent human library in like South Australia. And the people that you check out, like, for example, there might be a refugee, or there might be somebody who's Muslim, or there might be somebody who's like deaf and blind. And so you check out this person, and the person is a volunteer, and they're volunteering to have a half hour conversation with you. Or longer if you, you know, check them out again or go overdue or whatever the you know, terminology is. But the opportunity is that you interact with a real person and understand something about a culture, about a situation, about someone's life that you would never have otherwise understood over a cup of coffee.
That is so cool. I wish we had one where I live in Denver. And it kind of makes me wonder if we had a little more of that, we'd have a little less of the manipulated outrage because we'd have more empathy, you know?
Yes, I like how you're putting the pieces together. Just, that's really good.
Seems to me that, you know, half of our challenge right now is a dehumanization of people who don't believe what we believe. So
that's true.
Yeah. That's so true. It would be very cool. And I think that, you know, really taps into the power of empathy, and it's fascinating, and the whole human mode thing. And when you first said it, I thought you were going to go down the path of you check out an expert, but that's not what you're saying, right? It's you check out someone that you want to learn more about. Like, it's just, it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and you know, they're not prescriptive about it. So, I mean, you could be like, hey, let me check out a SEO guy so I can, you know, get more SEO of my stuff. I suppose that would be possible too. But, you know, the examples that were mostly used were, you know, so have a conversation with somebody who's transgender, right?
Yeah.
And understand something about that.
It makes me want to build a traveling human library, you know, truck that you could, I don't know what that would be. We'd all like maybe just a big, you know, VW van. We'd all get in it and go across the country. It'd be very interesting.
Hey, I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm in.
So, okay, great. Great. You put together the music. I'll drive. It'll be perfect.
Great. I like it.
Let's wrap up kind of, I know there's a lot more in the book, but just high level, when you think about the trends and what's happening, what is the implication on that onto our innovation efforts?
I think there's a couple. I mean, one is that real innovation comes from looking outside of your industry. Mm-hmm. You can't innovate from inside because that tends to be just incremental.
Yeah.
And so, you know, big thing that I spend a lot of time doing is crossing industries and finding relationships between them and helping organizations and leaders and, you know, and just, you know, smart people see those connections because a lot of times they're not exposed to them. So that's kind of one thing that I think is super important.
Yeah, that is. It's, you know, I think that intersection of seemingly random is where the great innovation is found. It's not in looking at the same thing at the same place, at the same time, with the same people.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's definitely one thing. And then I think the other thing is just the discipline to look elsewhere and to be a, what I call an idea collector, right? So I spend most of the year collecting stories and examples and interviews and, you know, just all sorts of stuff so that by the end of the year, when we start doing with my team, collaborating on figuring out what this trend is going to be, we have a lot of sources of input. And so a lot of times what ends up happening for us is we are smart people. We go to events, we write down stuff that we think is important, and then we lose the piece of paper.
Yeah.
And that is the worst, because what you're doing is you're losing your best stuff. You're losing your best ideas. You're losing your inspiration. And that is a tragedy.
It's the worst. Yeah.
So, you know, one of the biggest things I try and teach is like, how do we take notes more effectively so that we don't lose our best thinking? Like, we actually use it. We leverage it, because that's what we all want. And I think a lot of times we're just not taught how to do it.
I'm curious, when you're out there looking, are you filtering what you're capturing? Or at that stage, are you saying, hey, whatever makes me go, huh, is worthy enough to write down or capture, and we'll sort it out later? And I'm asking because I think oftentimes in the world we tend to filter too soon. And I'm curious how you approach it.
Yeah, I do. Capture things based on, oh, that's interesting. And I don't necessarily know why it's significant, but I do one very important thing that I think a lot of people don't do when they start that process, even that same process, is they save it because it's interesting, but they don't write down why they thought it was interesting.
I have a whole notebook of that. And I'm like, what did I mean by that?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, when I rip a story out of a magazine, for example, and I've said, oh, that's interesting, I will at least underline the part that I found interesting or what I thought was interesting, because then when I go back to it 8 months later to try and curate it into part of a trend, I know what I was thinking about it, not just that I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, that's really smart. I cannot tell you how much, I think probably great insight I've lost over the years when I've gone back and thought, oh, that phrase is interesting, but I have no idea why at all whatsoever now because I'm out of context. But so for launch readers out there listening, I want you to think about that. One, capture everything that makes you go, huh? And two, write down why it made you go, huh? So that you actually have that to reference later. You know, one of the things I really appreciate about your, I don't know if you call it a book or report, it's kind of both, is that you teach people how to predict. You spend a lot of time actually with how can you go out there and curate and look at the world and see these things. What are some of the key skills that launch readers can employ to predict and win the future?
Well, there's one is being more observant. So seeing processes in action, paying attention, not walking down the street with your phone and texting and barely not bumping into stuff. So being observant, being curious. One of my favorites is being fickle, which I think is an odd thing.
Yeah, tell me more about that.
Yeah, so being fickle to me is kind of along the lines of what we were just talking about, which is you save something because you think it's interesting, but you don't put too much pressure on yourself to figure out its meaning in that moment. You move on. And so to me, being fickle means you capture something and you move on. You move on to the next thing. And I remember that I kind of, you know, back in my agency days, like this was something I had to learn because I was being brought into so many different brainstorms and coming up with ideas so quickly and trying to understand a client's business in such a rapid pace that once I finished something and I delivered ideas, I had to move on immediately.
Yeah.
And almost forget about that. Otherwise, I would just dwell too long on something and I wouldn't be able to do my job very well. And so it was something I learned out of necessity from the agency world, but then I realized that there's an upside to this too, which is that you can accomplish more if you're able to leave something behind and move to something else.
Is that a skill of, or I guess an action of writing it down, capturing it, because then your brain goes, okay, got it, check, and then you can move on? Is that a mind space issue or something else?
I think it's just a choice. I mean, we dwell on things that we choose to dwell on.
Yeah.
And I realize that different people's brains work differently. And so, you know, someone else, you know, they may not be able to stop themselves from continually thinking about it. And so maybe some of it is just the way that my brain works, because I also, you know, just to give you a little insight into my personality, like I'm one of those people where if I get on a plane and I close my eyes, I'm fast asleep.
So, for the whole plane ride?
For the whole plane ride, yeah. For the whole plane ride.
Kill me. I can fall asleep for the first 5 minutes and then I'm awake.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I'm totally willing to entertain the idea that this may not necessarily be something that's easy for a lot of people. It happens to be something that I think I can do because my brain kind of, I can switch it on and off. Maybe I don't switch it on quickly enough in some situations. But, you know, but that choice, right, to say, okay, yeah, now I'm going to move to this other thing and try my best, whether I succeed or not, to not keep going backwards to that other thing. I think it can help.
I think there's a lot of power in that. And launch readers out there listening, think about how much mind space it takes when you dwell on stuff. I think actually the fickle is what makes being observant possible. I think it's hard to be have your eyes open, be observant, take in new stuff if you're constantly dwelling on something else.
Yeah, that's right. And then, you know, the last thing that I tell people is to be elegant. And this is probably my English major talking because I study a lot
of
like.
Not a word people use often. Go on.
And yeah, so, you know, if you think about like even advertising, copywriting or poetry, like every word is intentional and it's chosen because it has some sort of significance. And to me, like that's a verbal version of elegance because it says I'm choosing something specifically because I want it to mean something that is defined and that is different than anything else.
Was there,
and language is beautiful that way because you can do that.
What do you think happens to a person when they become observant, fickle, and elegant? How does that impact their day-to-day and their work?
I think that it allows them to see the things that other people don't see because most people are not being observant in that way. Most people are not capturing something and moving on. Most people are not making those connections between ideas. And if you think about one definition of innovation and creativity, it's being able to see what other people don't see.
Yeah.
And that is really at the heart of what I try and get across in this book, which is that is a skill that any of us can learn how to do. And it has huge value if we can learn how to do it.
As you know, as you said, you update the report every year. As you were bringing it into 2018, were there any surprises in what you learned or when you pulled all of that observation together?
Yeah, I mean, there's always surprises. One of the questions that I always get is, okay, you've been doing this for 8 years now. You've predicted 15 trends every year. So you have an arsenal now of like 100 plus trends. Did any of them come true? Like, were you right? And so there's an entire appendix for the book, which is, I think, pretty unique among people who talk about futures and predictions, where we go through and we review and we rate every past trend prediction with a letter grade as to whether it continued to accelerate, whether it continued to have relevance, whether it didn't have the same relevance that we thought it would.
Fizzled out, maybe.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's a lot of transparency behind this. And the reason we do that is, first of all, to inspire more trust in the fact that we're not the sort of people that can never admit that we didn't get anything right or wrong. But also we want people to see that sometimes these things do shift over time and what happens when they do. How does the idea of a trend still resonate?
And it's also not a glass ball, right? I mean, things, a context of the future changes every day. So what could look right one day may not be right the next.
Yeah, and I really, you know, I describe sometimes myself as a near futurist, right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm really looking at like the next year. And you know, it's not that I don't believe in long-term planning or thinking about the vision kind of far out, but even the long-term decisions that we make in business and the long-term strategies we put into place, those initial steps happen in the short term. So that's why, you know, the focus of this report is the way that it is.
So have you ever, on a, you know, large wall or whiteboard, mapped out all the trends over the years to see where they've connected the dots, you know, those trends themselves over time, like maybe one that you wrote about 5 years ago and you look at today and you're like, oh, that's really a translation of that, you know, 5 years later. I have this vision of like a serial killer wall with like string and, you know, whiteboards. Yep. And have you done that? And have you found anything in that?
So it's interesting that you should ask that, because we are in the midst right now of working on a project with Microsoft where we're building a whole data visualization around all of the trends that have been predicted in the past and what the relationships between them are, so that essentially, like, I could do that in a room by myself, but this is going to be really cool because you'll be able to visually do it yourself online. And the analogy is less of the string on the board and a little bit more of kind of the periodic table of elements in terms of how it moves around. But it's going to be really cool once it's done. Like, I've been seeing some of the development phases of it, and it's using this awesome technology they have called Power BI. And so it's going to be just a really, really nice visual.
So less serial killer wall, more scientific. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. That's
and is
right.
That
that's
gonna,
where we're going.
Is that going to be public?
Yeah, it will be. Yeah.
Very cool. Before I ask you the last question, where can people go to connect with you, learn more?
Easy. So Non-Obvious Company is the name of the company, and I have a lot of the materials there. Also, I have a personal website that has kind of videos of me and things like that, which is just my name. So RohitBhargava.com. So, and then you can just Google either Non-Obvious or my name, and you'll find your way to any of this stuff as well.
We'll put all of those links in the show notes too, so people can quickly get there. I would really encourage everyone to go out there and get the 2018 report, because it is extremely insightful. And this is coming from someone who spent a lot of time thinking about patterns and trends. And there was stuff in there that, you know, after I think you crystallize it, I went, oh my gosh, of course. But I couldn't put a framework around it to say, here's what's going on and here's why. Now I feel like I can take that and actually say, now here's the impact on us too, because I understand it in a way that I couldn't quite get my hands around before. So what's one piece of advice you have for launched readers as we move into 2018?
I would say one piece of advice is I love to empathize with magazines. I'm a big magazine reader. And what I do is I buy magazines that are not targeted towards me. So I'll buy like Modern Farmer magazine or Teen Vogue. And by reading them, I'll understand something about someone who's different. And that gives me more perspective. So I would say, in a world where it's easy to read the stuff that you agree with or focus on the same type of media, like, expand your media diet, read something different.
I love the idea of the magazine being the $3.99 version of the human library. If you can't have a human library, go to a magazine. I have to say, I think that's a really powerful piece of advice. I hope we all spend a little more time steeping ourselves in other people's worlds, putting ourselves in their shoes. I think so much great innovation and empathy and I think just compassion for the world comes out of that. So I'm so glad that you kind of closed out on that advice. I think that's so important. So hopefully we can have you back when, after this Microsoft project goes live, we can talk a little bit about this periodic table of trend elements and how it all fits together. So thank you so much for joining us. This has been really enlightening, and I'm really thrilled that we get to launch 2018 with this type of knowledge at our fingertips.
Me too. And this has been a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
I know. I'm blown away too. So now that you know what's ahead of you, how are you going to take those trends? And as Rohit and I talked about, think differently about how you do business so you don't get left behind, as these trends, you know, they're going to impact your customers' world and their expectations of you. Good question, right? Well, to no surprise, I want you to rock 2018. So allow me to suggest that you go to our website, gotolaunchstreet.com, and get access to our online innovation courses and programs. You can find them in our on-demand section on the website. That's where you'll get the tools you need to put this knowledge and more into daily practice and, dare I say, get a head start on the competition. That's right. Your competition, I'm going to venture to say, is still crafting their 2018 plan. So how about we get ahead of them and start implementing the things we're learning right away? I know I'm already doing that. I think it sounds like a pretty good idea, right? And you know what other launch readers have told us is that the video course on playing on the fringes in particular is a tool that really helped them take these trends and apply them to their world so they can go further faster. Bam! That's in our Innovation on Demand program. So if you're interested in taking what you just learned and putting it into action that leads to measurable results, go to gotolaunchstreet.com, G-O-T-O, launchstreet.com, and click on Innovation on Demand and get your VIP access. I promise you, it is worth every penny. Here's to rocking that 2018 role. Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.